Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
One place where the conversation about climate change matters most is at International Climate Talks. For the past couple of weeks, leaders from across the globe have been meeting in New York to write new sustainable development goals. They're hoping governments around the world will sign on next year. Activist and writer Felix Dodds has been at those meetings. In fact, he's been at nearly every major climate and sustainability summit since 1990. Sarah Nix asked Dodds why, after so many missed opportunities, he still believes international action on climate change is possible.
I've always been an internationalist at heart. I guess from an early age, I believe that countries stood a better chance of solving the problems by negotiating rather than through armed conflict. And the UN processes offer an opportunity for the different views to be exchanged. And what I've found is it's the building of trust between different countries or different negotiators that is really vital to trying to find a way through what are very difficult issues that are facing the future.
So you entered this arena in about 1990, right?
I did, yes. My first meeting was on the Montreal Protocol, which actually was 89. And so that is a very good success story about how CFCs was found to impact on the ozone layer. And governments came together within a very, very short period of time. I think they found the hole in the ozone layer in 83. By 85, they'd created an international framework for dealing with it. And by 89, which is the meeting I went to, they decided a date before the end of the century to actually get CFCs out of the atmosphere.
Of course, that's a single issue kind of problem with a very clear remedy. But climate change is a whole other ball of wax.
Yeah, it is. To begin with, the issue was, did the scientists have their predictions right? Were these gases actually causing climate change?
Could you give me an example maybe of how you started those conversations with people who maybe weren't really sure that the science was bearing out? And how did you begin to broach the subject or get them on side about these issues?
I think that once you've got some of the evidence that things are moving in a particular direction, then the government officials may be taking a formal position that may be difficult, but they're underneath that trying to work out what needs to be done. So they are actually quite open to a conversation on that. How you change the policy depends on, to some extent, what the issue is. You can do it through technical briefings. You can do it through coffee bar discussions. You can take them out for a drink. One of the interesting things I find about this process is the real thirst by the civil servants from all countries, to some extent, to have the knowledge to be able to make better informed suggestions. So I think there's a real openness to that in these negotiations.
Well, zooming out a little bit, how do you find generally it's most successful for you to frame these issues when you're talking to people? I mean, there is a lot of kind of dire messaging, particularly around climate change, in the public sphere right now. Do you use those techniques? Do you talk more about solutions? How do you approach it?
No, I mean, I don't use the dire stuff. I think it can be very counterproductive. We're in a situation now where a lot of the policies that we need to do are understood. And the issue now is how do we help those to be accelerated?
So it sounds like you're taking a more kind of constructive approach to these conversations. What's your sense of how decision makers around the globe feel, I mean, really feel, not think, about a future of climate change? I mean, is there a sense of impending doom? Or I know, of course, it's probably difficult to take the emotional temperature of the entire globe, but I guess that's kind of what I'm asking you for.
So I think that that the people who are engaged in trying to address this are all doing it, I think, from an attempt to try and find a way through that we can all do this together. But there are problems. I mean, so one of the problems that we suffered in 2009 at the climate meeting in Copenhagen was that the US president couldn't actually sign up to anything, because whatever he signs up to has to go through Congress and has to go through the Senate if it's a legally binding agreement. And it's, I think, 60 votes you need in the Senate. And I don't think there has been any ratified since 1992. And so if the US can't actually deliver its part of the discussion, it makes it very, very difficult for the other countries to feel that they should take the burden on themselves.
So it sounds like there's a sense of urgency, but also maybe a sense of frustration.
I think the frustration is there. I think that the people are working, trying to find ways to get round the political barriers that exist.
You know, it seems like pretty quickly from the first discussion starting in 89 that the climate change conversation got wrapped up with questions of global, social, and economic development. How does shifting to sustainable development change the conversation?
So I think that we made a mistake at the very beginning of the climate negotiations, and I understand why the mistake was made. They approached it in a very similar way as they'd done for CFCs, you know, which was the reduction of carbon dioxide, the reduction of methane. I actually think it would have been better to go for a convention which identified work that needed to be done on agriculture, that work needed to be done on urban issues or water or energy.
Kind of those human face aspects of it.
Exactly. And you could have inspired business to come under that and start to make real commitments. And I think we would have been well on our way now to being able to deliver those targets that we'd been talking about. So the climate change negotiations have changed a little in the more recent years, where some of those issues are now coming in. And it's hoped that these new global goals that will be agreed in 2015, which will have goals on urban issues, on goals on energy, goals on consumption and production, that they will then also have an impact on climate change.
You know, it's very curious to hear you say that, because I had wondered if by rolling human development and quality of life into conversations about climate change, we had bitten off more than we could chew.
No, I think we would have done exactly the opposite. I think if we'd have done that at the beginning of the process, then we would have inspired a generation of people at all levels to engage and find solutions. And I think by not doing that, we haven't opened the engine of change that could have happened.
You know, back in 2000, I think it was, the UN put forward a list of Millennium Development Goals, environmental sustainability along with human development, and they were ideally to be met by 2015, which is next year, and it seems like we're still a long way from meeting most of those targets. Are the goals and meeting the goals the actual end game, or is there something else?
So some of the goals have been met. The one on slum dwellers has been met, and I think the water target has been met, and some of the education ones of it. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. What it did do was it focused government development agencies on funding particularly priority areas that needed to be advanced, and I think it was successful in doing that. And the conversation we're having now is, what are the replacements for those? So these international agreements play a significant role in first sharing the best practice of a particular issue at a particular time, but then they offer an opportunity to give policy guidance on the way forward to address those issues. It can also inspire other groups to get engaged. And so the business community, particularly through the UN Global Compact, have had many of their companies commit to work on those original 8 Millennium Development Goals. And so you've had a more enlightened corporate response by those companies. With the goals that will be adopted in 2015, I think that will have the same impact. And this is where you get into the solution stuff. The more you can start to innovate, the more chances we have of addressing these issues early, and the more opportunities we have for inspiring a generation to become those new entrepreneurs that can address these future challenges early.
You know, you've been doing this work for quite a while now. I wonder if you have ever fatigue. I mean, it's a lot of issues to be keeping your eyes on. How do you personally keep yourself motivated?
Because I see in the people I talk to in the governments the same motivation, that they want to make the right decisions. I mean, what's been fascinating over the last 5 or 6 years has been the emergence of new leadership from developing countries to address these things. And I get inspired by their inspiration and their vision to try and, you know, make sure that this world is something which we can hand on to future generations in a state that we would have liked to have inherited it.
Felix Dodd's book about international negotiation is called How to Lobby at Intergovernmental Meetings. Mine is a cafe latte.